Today is Monday, September 20th, 2010. I'm Andrew Longhurst, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us for a full hour of independent news here on News 101. Today we'll bring you special coverage of UBC President Stephen Toop's annual town hall held earlier this afternoon at the Chan Center. In the hour-long forum, President Toop provided an update on Place and Promise, UBC's strategic plan, and answered questions to a crowd of over 100. Also in campus news, we'll be bringing you an update on the transportation consultation process here at UBC. In provincial news, we'll be bringing you an update in the Fight HST campaign. And in our weekly segment with the Tyee.ca, we'll be speaking with Jeff Dembicki about the prominent U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who had previously supported climate change legislation in the U.S. and has now changed his mind. We'll also have your arts report, and we'll have a lot more on the show. We also have some coverage from the Q&A, obviously, as I mentioned before, about Stephen Toop's town hall. That's right here on News 101, your source for independent news. But first, here are your headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Good news for 33 men trapped in a Chilean mine. Today, officials say they have completed the drilling of a borehole, which rescuers intend to use as an escape route for the miners. Work on the borehole has been underway for weeks. The men have been kept alive with supplies lowered through a hole only about 4 inches wide. Now the new shaft must be widened enough to extract the men. Officials say that could take up to 6 more weeks. Hotly contested elections last January pitted the Sri Lankan political establishment against a celebrated army general. But soon after the general's electoral defeat, FSRN reported that he was arrested on what he called politically motivated charges. Now former General Sarath Fonseca has been found guilty. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam reports.
This is the first time Sri Lanka's military court has probed charges against a top military official. Today's ruling is the second conviction against a former army chief, Sarath Fonseca, currently a parliamentarian. Fonseca played a major role in defeating the Tamil Tiger rebels in May last year. He entered into politics after retirement to challenge President Mahinda Rajapaksa. Soon after, Fonseca was accused of entering politics while in uniform and irregularities of arms procurement during his tenure in the army. He has denied the charges, but last month, the court found him guilty of the former and was stripped of his military rank. In the latest verdict for the crime of illegal arms procurement, a jail term of 3 years has been recommended to the president, who is also the commander-in-chief of the nation. Ponnaiah Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
A leading Pakistani politician living in exile in London has been stabbed to death near his home Imran Farooq was a popular politician in Karachi with the MQM party. According to The Guardian, stores were closed and public transport parked for fear of a renewed outbreak of ethnic violence in the city. Last month, violence followed another MQM politician's murder, leaving many dead and wounded. Authorities do not know yet if Farooq's murder was politically motivated. The party has called for 10 days of mourning to be observed in Pakistan. As part of the International Days of Support for Bradley Manning, events are organized in the U.S. and around the world. Manning is the military intelligence analyst who allegedly leaked classified material on the Internet. For FSRN, Salim Rizvi reports on one of the first events in New York City.
Braving a large storm in the city on Thursday evening, a small group of supporters of Army PFC Bradley Manning gathered to call for his release. The infamous leaked Army video was shown documenting the killing of 12 Iraqis in 2007. The U.S. Army is charging Manning with espionage and computer crimes for leaking the video footage to the website WikiLeaks, which then decrypted it and released worldwide. Army officials have condemned his action and warned that they may lead to the deaths of American soldiers in the theaters of war. But supporters insist that soldiers like PFC Manning should be encouraged to bring out the truth. They say Manning should be awarded, not imprisoned. A military mom herself, Elaine Brower, is a member of the Bradley Manning Support Network.
If he did do this, he is a hero because he's only 22. He's a member of the intelligence service in the Army. Dan Ellsberg was older and he wasn't part of the military. He had already done his military service, so they couldn't court-martial him. This is a whole different ballgame with this kid.
Now the supporters of Manning hope the defense team will get the charges against him dropped, much like Ellsberg did after leaking the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War. Manning is currently being detained in Quantico, Virginia. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
And finally, ozone depletion has all but halted, according to a report released by the United Nations. The ozone layer blocks cancer-causing UV rays from the sun. The report says everywhere except in polar regions, the ozone layer is expected to recover to pre-1980 levels by 2050. The authors credit the global phase-out of dozens of ozone-depleting chemicals once used in spray cans and refrigerators. Scientists are still not seeing an increase in ozone levels, but the UN says international efforts have been a success. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for providing us with those great headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website at fsrn.org. We now go to our weekly feature with the tidy.ca. And on the line, I have Jeff Dembicki, and he's going to be talking about a recent post he published on The Hook, which is I'll let him explain it. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Maybe if you want to just, explain what you recently published about on The Hook and what The Hook is, for those that don't know it.
So The Hook is the Tai'i's political blog, and it's updated about four or five times a day. And I just put a piece up about a Republican senator who once declared that the U.S. needs to take action on climate change. This is Republican Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, and he just visited the oil sands Alberta and now refers to them as a national treasure for Canada and the United States.
So clearly a complete reversal. Many see this as a complete reversal, going from backing the Democrats in Congress and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who's been very outspoken against dirty oil. Going from that to then Lindsey Graham, U.S. Republican senator, saying this is something that's a national treasure and we basically need to keep extracting it.
Yeah, and some well-read environmental bloggers are basically flabbergasted by this whole thing. I mean, it's happened in stages. Back in January of this year, Graham made his comments, and he said global warming is this serious issue that the U.S. needs to start dealing with. And at the time, he got a pretty strong reaction from the Republican Party and its supporters. There were those in the conservative blogosphere who actually referred to him as wussy pants and a girly man. And then this summer, Graham, who had helped write climate change legislation with two Democrat congressmen, and this would have been the most wide-ranging climate change plan in the entire history of the United States. Graham bailed from this, and now the recent trip from the oil sands is sort of being seen by some commentators as a further reversal for the senator.
Do you think this has maybe a lot to do with the upcoming election? Is he standing for election? Re-election, rather.
I believe so. He vowed in this new election that if Republicans took the House, they would stop any draconian environmental policies that would be bad for business. That's a direct quote from Graham. Mm. And it is ironic because the climate change legislation he helped write would almost certainly have limited imports from the oil sands. Because many acknowledge that producing and combusting fuel from Alberta's oil sands creates 3 to 5 times more greenhouse gases than conventional oil. And the United States Environmental Protection Agency estimated that oil sands fuel is actually 82% more emissions intensive. So the plan that Graham had helped write would likely have reduced imports from the oil sands. And now he's telling the Globe and Mail that he is prepared to do everything he can to make sure oil sands production is not impeded because of U.S. policy. And that's another quote.
Do you think he's just taking advantage of the political climate right now? Obviously, the Democrats, their prospects for the elections aren't looking too great right now. Do you think this is sort of just representative of that?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, nobody can be too sure why anyone would exhibit such a strong reversal on an issue like climate change. But certainly he's facing pressure within his own party to not support efforts that could potentially reduce imports from the oil sands, which many in the U.S. see as an essential source of energy for the country, especially as it attempts to become more self-sufficient in terms of energy and not as reliant on sources such as the Middle East or Venezuela.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House, recently took a tour of the tar sands, the oil sands. Is that correct?
She didn't take a tour, but she visited with the Premier of Alberta and also some environmental representatives in Ottawa.
Okay.
And both sides came away from that claiming that Pelosi had made statements that supported their positions. But Pelosi is a lot more critical of fuel sources such as the oil sands that could create much more climate-intensive fuel for the U.S. than someone as Graham is, as we can see from the comments from both visits.
Interesting. Anything else do you think that will come out of this?
I'm not too sure at the moment, but it's definitely undermining the faith that many in the U.S. environmental community had that a climate bill could be drafted that would bridge the ideological gap between Republicans and Democrats. I think that's taken a big hit.
Mm-hmm. Clearly. Well, Jeff, thank you again for joining us on News 101. I really appreciate it. And maybe we look forward to, we'll see what comes out of this and the ramifications if it... Maybe he will just simply secure his re-election. Hard to say.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeff. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Jeff Dembicki from the Tyee.ca, the online news magazine that you can find at the Tyee.ca. And we're now going to take a quick break. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces. all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
And that's right. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. In provincial news, the Fight HST campaign, led by former Premier Bill Van Der Zalm, has announced it will kick off the MLA recall campaign as early as November 15th. Premier Gordon Campbell has decided not to conduct a referendum on the controversial new tax, instead opting for a non-binding plebiscite in September of 2011. Van Der Zalm says Premier Campbell can call off the recall plan by meeting the following conditions for the upcoming referendum. It must be a simple majority, it must be binding on government, it must be held under the legally binding referendum act or such other legislative means to give effect to the results and regulate campaign spending by all parties, it must be held this year, and finally, the question must be drafted by Elections BC and approved by both the government and Fight HST. Fight HST will hold a weekly contest to see which ridings can sign up the most canvassers between September 27th and November 15th. The first day recalls can begin. Lead organizer Chris Delaney explained, quote, each week the riding with the least canvassers signed up will move to the back of the line. At the end of the contest, the top three ridings with the most canvassers will win the right to conduct the first recalls under the Fight HST banner. A new recall will then launch every month after the first three in order of how many canvassers they signed up. Eight provincial constituencies have signed up so far, according to Delaney, for what they are calling MLA Survivor Recall, Vote Them Off the Island. And now we move to the Arts Report, and in studio I have the pleasure of having Adam Janusz here. Adam, thanks for joining me in studio.
It's my pleasure. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. So, busy week with The Fringe. What do you have for us?
Oh, it has been a very busy week. We, of course, did a live show on Wednesday, and last night was the closing night festivities with awards night, where they gave away rubber chickens as their form of statuettes for the winners of the sort of the best of The Fringe. There were six winners, and the Arts Report team was there to snag all the winners and interview them. Everyone who was there, that is, there was two of the winners that were actually in shows during the awards night, so they couldn't be there. And then we also spoke to Colin. Sorry, let me just pull it up here. The Critics' Choice Awards presenters, which included Colin Thomas and I think it's Kathleen Oliver. We talked to them about what went into their selection process, because they ended up picking two plays for Critics' Choice. So, okay. What you'll hear now is the final podcast for this Fringy Life, which has all the highlights from last night.
Okay, and here that clip is.
Welcome to This Fringy Life, a series of podcasts about the 2010 Vancouver International Fringe Festival, celebrating spontaneous, surprising, and remarkable pieces of theater. This Fringy Life is produced by CITR 101.9 FM and is available on the web at CITR.ca and VancouverFringe.com.
Awards night marked the end of the 26th Vancouver Fringe Festival, and CITR's Arts Report was there, including Nick Sartori and myself, Adam Janusz, to get the winners' reactions. The Pick of the Fringe had six winners, including Wanderlust. Here's Martin Dockery on what the award means to him.
Well, now, first of all, it means I don't have to go out and buy my own rubber chicken, which was on my list of things to do, and so that crossed off now.
That's a plus.
It's just an honor, you know? I'm so psyched. Like, here at the Fringe, you get to realize your dreams. I always had this dream where I would show up on stage in nothing but my underwear, and last night I was in the cabaret on stage in my underwear. So if nothing else, I was allowed to realize that dream. At the time when I would have those dreams, it would be a nightmare, but that has nothing to do with my show or this award I won. But anyway, yeah, it's been great here. It's been like a great reception that I've had for this show, Wanderlust, and I'm really psyched to be able to do it again next Sunday.
Martin will also be doing his show, The Bike Trip, as a fundraiser for The Fringe on September 22nd. Another Fringe winner was Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, accepted by Jesse Van Ryn, who was feeling good.
I'm elated. I'm very excited. The cast and the crew and the director and the stage manager would be very excited to be here right now. But they've got a show that's sold out, and there's lots of people there, so they had to be there. Otherwise, the audience would be disappointed. So, yeah.
And so they talked a little bit about how you guys sort of came out of the woodwork. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, Relevant Theatre partnered with Broadway West in June. Broadway West had always anticipated bringing the show here. They had done an original run at the Vertigo Theatre in Calgary. And when they decided they wanted to do it in Vancouver, they decided to partner with a group that was already here. So we were able to rehearse the show and everything. We had a few actors come in from out of town. We put together a production team. It's a very tech-heavy show for a Fringe show, so that was going through that process was really interesting. But the amazing people that we had in this crew and the staff and crew at the Fire Hall Arts Centre where we did the show was definitely having everyone together was what made it so sweet. So, yeah, it was great.
13 is a musical about teens made by teens. We found the cast huddled outside Performance Works, buzzing after their Pick of the Fringe nod.
So tell me, as students working on this project, what do you take away from this? What is the biggest thing you've learned working on this show?
Be a good person. Karma. Karma. Karma's a biatch.
Like, that's what the storyline taught us.
Okay.
Like, be nice to everyone. Like, it's okay to grow up. Like, mm-hmm. Weird things happen,
but experience-wise, I mean, we all have so many lessons learned, and we're all family now, and it's just...
Mm. And I don't know, I feel kind of, like, more professional with my acting now, and I've learned a lot of lessons about my voice, and, yeah.
Ryan Gladstone accepted two awards, one for Freud versus his ego, and for Moving Along. I asked him what resonated with audiences about Freud versus his ego.
I would say two words, penis and vagina. I think people like dirty stuff.
It gets a rise out of people. Really.
It does get a rise, so to speak, yeah, for sure.
and let me ask you about Moving Along.
Moving Along is great, yeah. I mean, it's a amazingly brilliant show. He deserves it. I wanted to, when he got the award, I wanted to, like, phone him and have him make a little speech
live,
or something, but... he didn't respond to my texts, unfortunately, in time. So.
So now, is the story that he couldn't bring the show to Vancouver, and then you kind of took it?
That show, Chris wrote Moving Along in 2001, mm-hmm. and that's when I saw it. And then he re-updated it and toured it again last year. And then this year, we had a spot at the Fringe, and Chris is a good friend of ours, and he was like, "Oh, golly, I've never brought that show to Vancouver."
Okay.
And we said, "Well, golly, you should bring it." So,
great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Critics' Choice Award ended up a tie between Limbo and Raccoonery. Here's Georgia Strait critics Kathleen Oliver and Colin Thomas explaining the difficulty of selecting a winner.
Yeah, well, we had five shows in the final that were all nominees, okay. And any of those shows could have won. Absolutely any of them. We didn't want to have anybody in there that was, you know, just a charitable nomination or a pretty good show but wasn't going to win. So all of those were contenders. And in terms of, you know, I guess the finalists for me were really shows that... the same thing. It's the excitement meter,
right?
You know,
and that kind of becomes a tiebreaker.
Kind of, but you know, like Andrew, and part of it's like innovation, part of it's the sets of skills. Like with Morgan's show, Raccoonery, there are so many different skills involved. Like there's music, there's acting, there's a comedy, there's like great writing. And Andrew's show is doing something, Limbo is doing something very, very different, right? Mm-hmm. It's a confessional monologue that has really emotional depth. And we just couldn't choose between those two shows because they're both so good in very different ways.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think all of them are shows that really take you for a ride, and each of those five, it's a very different ride.
Mm-hmm.
Die Roten Punkte, if you've ever seen them, yeah. It's just like you get on and you go higher and higher and higher, right? It's crazy. And Oh, the Humanity was just a tremendous script, really beautifully realized by fairly young artists, a young company at any rate.
Two more awards were given out, and both went to Marissa Smith for Wicked Shorts. The Joanna Moretta Award recognizes an exemplary contribution to the theater community. The Cultivating the Fringe Award provides mentorship and a run at the Culch next season. Here is Cindy Reed of the Culch explaining why Wicked Shorts deserved the honor.
I think it was the combination of four different playwrights and the director, Marissa, her use of space at the Wicked Cafe. Mm. And how it was four very distinct voices, but the way they all worked together was really beautiful and seamless, and just gave me just a really great experience, a very fulfilling experience.
Excellent.
And, you know, it can go in so many directions in the next stage, and I think it'll be really fun to work on that.
Marissa barely made it to awards night as she's in another play, The Power of Yes, at the Jericho Arts Center. We found her surrounded by a group of admirers.
So you get a mentorship and a run at the Culch. How does that feel? Has that sunk in?
It is. It's sinking in right now. So it's not a sinking feeling. It's a great feeling.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you get to do these two things. What do you think that will do for your theater making?
I don't know. A lot possibilities. You know. A lot of support and it just feels so great. You know, like worked really hard to get here and now I can have the support to go somewhere else with it, and I'm just, yeah, excited about that.
Tickets to the Pick of the Fringe and fundraiser plays are available now at VancouverFringe.com. Well, that's it for this Fringy Life 2010. Thanks for listening. Join me, Adam Janusz, every Wednesday at 5 p.m. for the Arts Report for in-depth coverage of Vancouver arts and culture on CITR 101.9 FM.
So that was the final episode of this Fringy Life. You can get all seven of them at CITR.ca. And just as a final note, ticket sales at the Fringe this year were up 25%. You know, and then we had these podcasts up, so, you know, you make the connection.
Well, yeah, I think we know where those increased sales came from.
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
Okay. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming in. And it was a fun Fringe filled with podcasts and lots of fringing and live broadcasts and all around craziness. So we look forward to some more coverage next week.
There's always more. Always more.
Okay.
Thanks.
Adam Janusz from the Arts Report. You can catch that Wednesdays at 5 o'clock. And you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we're going to go now for the weather. And for that, we're going to go to Daniel Casanova. And Daniel, sorry, I threw you on the spot, what's in store for this weather? I hope it's not going to be like the rain we had this morning as I was biking up the hill completely soaked and felt like I had just taken a shower. Is that what's in store? Please tell me it's not.
Well, in the short term, it's looking pretty good. The weather system has just moved away, and it will be gone by tomorrow morning, leaving us with good weather in the short term. Unfortunately, for the long-term forecast, we're going to start seeing rain again on Thursday and continuing for the rest of the week. The high temperatures this week will be hovering in the mid to high teens. So for tonight, it will be partly cloudy with 40% chance of showers this evening, low of 11 degrees overnight. For Tuesday, clearing in the morning, a mix of sun and cloud for the rest of the day, high of 17 degrees and a low of 10. On Wednesday, a mix of sun and cloud, high of 17 degrees, low of 9. For Thursday, we're having the start of rain, high of 15, low of 11 degrees. For Friday, rain with a high of 16, low of 11. On Saturday, rain again with a high of 17 degrees, low of 12. And finally for Sunday, rain yet again with a high of 17 degrees, low of 13. Currently it is 16 degrees and partly cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 18 degrees and a low of 10. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Castanova.
Okay, Daniel, well, it sounds like we're, based on those averages, we're looking a little chilly right now, so hopefully we'll maybe, you know, get some sun in here. I don't know.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. Okay.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, if Vancouver cooperates. Okay, again, thanks so much, Daniel. Daniel Castanova bringing us the weather. And now we're going to jump to campus news. In campus news, UBC Campus and Community Planning has brought together a media roundtable that will happen on Wednesday to discuss Phase 2 of Transportation Consultation 2010, which started this year. During Phase 1 in March 2010, community input was received on where to locate permanent transit facilities on campus and proposed cycling improvements. In Phase 2, three options are being presented for community consideration: a centralized bus facility, binodal facility, or a Westbrook Transit Mall. Campus and community planning will also be discussing the campus cycling plan. We'll be bringing you full coverage next Monday on this roundtable discussion, and I'll be attending that this Wednesday. So we'll definitely have some coverage of that and some comments to bring you on next Monday's edition of News 101. And in more campus news, the AMS Council has decided not to hold an October referendum to tie AMS fees to the Consumer Price Index, which would generate more funding for AMS programs and services. AMS academic Ben Capolacci saying, "We've hit a bend in the river, a fork in the road, and we'd be shooting ourselves in the foot by doing it now. Instead, the AMS will aim for next fall for a referendum." And in our continued coverage of campus news, I had the opportunity to attend the town hall with UBC President Stephen Toop. And in the hour-long forum, he provided a rundown of the accomplishments and presented on their strategic plan and how they're living up to that. And he also took some time to answer questions from students and members of the UBC community. Unfortunately, we don't have time for the full hour long of that, and you may not want to hear the whole thing anyway. So I've decided to bring you the question and answer session from the town hall today, which was at the Chan Center. So, and also I asked the first question after President Toop responds to questions sent to him via email. So my first question, and you should listen for it, is was about the South Campus development, and there's been recently more market rate housing and senior-specific housing on South Campus just off Westbrook at 16th, and I was curious to see if there was a plan for more affordable housing and rentals and student housing, and the preservation of the farm also ties into that area as well as an important aspect of that planning process. So the following is a Q&A with Stephen Toop at the town hall, today at the Chan Center at UBC.
We now have an opportunity to move to questions. Microphones are on either side of me, and I encourage you to use those mics and to identify who you are before asking a question. And I would ask that you try to make the questions relatively short so that other people who want to raise issues will have an opportunity to do so. While people are considering what they might like to ask, I was sent two questions by some of our terrific students, and I thought I would share those questions with you in a very brief response. The first was a question from from Alyssa Hogg, who's a student assistant in the Terry Project. The idea here was that Place and Promise and lots of initiatives on campus outside the classroom seem to be promoting the idea of global citizenship and the importance of contributing to something bigger than ourselves. And the question is, how is the university going to emphasize those values in our classrooms? How can we as a university truly promote global values like international engagement and intercultural engagement if we're not giving students the opportunities to do within a classroom setting what they might do outside? It's a very complex question, and I can only answer very briefly, but I'd emphasize that the student experience is not something that I think can be divided fully as to classroom and non-classroom. For me, the student experience is all about the totality of the experience of being at UBC, and so it's not less important that things are happening outside the classroom. In fact, in some ways, sometimes it may be more important, and I certainly would want to support that. On the other hand, I think there is a pointed comment here to us as professors particularly, and that is, are we really helping our students in the classroom understand not just the technical subject matter that we want to convey, but sort of how that subject matter relates to the broader purposes they may have as human beings? I think that is an interesting question for us to reflect on as professors, and there are, of course, many initiatives. We have now one of the largest community-based research programs in Canada. Many scholars here at UBC are doing community-based research and engaging their students in those opportunities with Aboriginal communities, with communities across the province, Canada, and internationally. In addition, community service learning opportunities are being expanded across the university very aggressively. So I think we just have to keep down that track, keep looking at it with great intention, and helping our students see that their classroom experience and their other experiences are not disconnected. The other question was from Harry Piggott, and it's a big one. He said that in his English 112 course, they've been exploring ideas around the concept of a university education. They're probably reading Cardinal Newman, recently beatified. He says, although I understand that the question might yield a very personal and subjective answer, I would like your response to the question, why are we here at the university? It's, of course, the right question. And I suppose all I can say is I think that that's a question that each one of us should be asking ourselves all the time. I think whether we're a staff member or a faculty member, a student, or an alumni volunteering, an alumnus volunteering with the university, why we're here is really the question that we should answer. For me, and I can only speak very personally, why I'm here goes back to my opening remarks, which is I think that universities are one of the only social institutions that has survived relatively intact since the medieval period that have the capacity to really change the future. And I can't think of a place that I would rather be than a university like UBC, which because of its scale, its scope, its ambition, and its clarity of purpose, I think can change the future of our community, can change the future of our Canadian society, and can contribute to the reshaping of the future of the entire world. And I don't say that lightly. We have that ability. There are so few places where one's work can have such value and such significance. And so for me, that's why we're in a university. Questions from the floor? Okay, I'm seeing a question about animal experimentation, and since no one's coming up, I'll read one of them and I'll try and answer it. Why does UBC experiment on cats, cut open their backs, implant electrodes into their heads? That's a question. And the short answer to that is that UBC does not do that. There's reference to past work that was done by one of our researchers. That work is no longer being done, and it gives me the opportunity to say a few words about animal research at a major world university. It's important, I think, to understand that we only involve animals in research when there are no alternatives that exist. We make every effort to minimize the use of animals in research, but, and it's a hugely important but, at some point, the effectiveness of new drugs and new treatments must be evaluated in living organisms before those treatments or drugs can be approved for human trials. Our animal care program and facilities are fully accredited in a compulsory fashion by the Canadian Council for Animal Care, and I can tell you personally that I've dealt with the Canadian Council ever since I arrived at UBC. They are very serious in their supervision, and UBC has invested in the last 4 years almost $100 million to improve our animal care facilities to make sure that we are meeting the requirements of the Canadian Council on Animal Care. In addition, we are scrutinized by the BC SPCA. I also want to point out a couple of other things. In 2009-2010, less than 9% of UBC's total research funding came from industry sources. Less than 9%. And of that total, the portion that came from pharmaceutical companies mostly funded tests on human subjects, not on animals. And I say that because I think there's some information in the wider society that's simply not correct. We are not highly dependent at most large research universities, and certainly not at UBC, on pharmaceutical company funded research. And that research is largely targeted at human trials. The last point I'll make on this question is that we have to understand that there's a very practical effect from drug research and other forms of research on animals. And that is that we actually do things that benefit the wider society. So, for example, I'll give you one UBC example. The first successful drug for treating age-related macular degeneration, which is the leading cause of adult blindness, and which was ultimately produced by a UBC spin-off, restoring the sight of hundreds of thousands of people around the world, did result from some animal trials. There are many other such examples. This is not superficial. This is not people just deciding to play around. It's people who, after very rigorous ethical review, which is constantly supervised, make decisions about how they're going to test in ways that make new therapies, new treatments available for the wider population. Yes?
You briefly spoke about the desire to pursue a reorientation in the development of South Campus. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of market rate housing being built on South Campus. Can you speak more about that desire, and also, are we going to see more student housing?
Yes. So we're clearly seeing more student housing, so I'll address that first, because I mentioned the Board of Governors has already approved 2,500 new student housing spaces over the course of the next three to four years. The first element of that is already under construction at Place Vanier, and so we have, I think, 563 new beds, if I remember correctly, coming online next year. So that's happening, and that's a fundamental commitment. But that's a particular form of student housing, student residences. We're also interested in making sure that students, staff, and faculty who want to live on the university campus have that opportunity. I'm sure that you know that we've engaged in some fairly creative ways of doing that in the past. So, for example, for faculty and staff, we have done some co-development arrangements where the staff or faculty member actually becomes the developer of his or her own property. This cuts out all sorts of marketing costs, it cuts out developer profit, and it means that you can actually deliver at a very positive rate for faculty and staff. I imagine, well, I know that we will do more of those sorts of developments. But in addition, and this is perhaps really the key point, the sustainability imperatives for the university tell us that we have to do something to change the style of housing that's being produced on South Campus. We've been told that for a number of years by our independent urban advisory panel, but we've been constrained. You have to understand why this has happened. We were constrained by something called the Official Community Plan that told us directly how much could be built on the South Campus, what it would have to look like, what the floor plates would be, and the result was really a form of suburban development. I think that what most people who look at these issues seriously now have determined is that the idea of sort of spreading out the development as far as possible is not any longer a sustainable approach to housing. And so we're looking to change the density rules to allow for somewhat smaller units. Right now, the average unit has to be 2 or 3 bedrooms because of the existing rules. That doesn't make sense. We did a survey of our faculty and staff last year, and we discovered that a very high percentage of our faculty and staff lives either alone or with one other person. And they're looking for smaller units that are hence more affordable. So there are a whole number of pieces that have to be put in place. The central one for me is increasing the density on some parts of the campus to allow for smaller units that are more affordable and that are more sustainable, as long as that's matched with a very strong creation of open spaces, parkland, amenities, community centers, etc. And for me, that's going to be the future of the evolution of development on the UBC campus. Much more sustainable because of the densities, and much more attention paid to all of the community amenities. I want to be fair. There's some great work that's already been done. One of our South Campus developments just won a major international award for community planning. But in my view, the constraints under which we've been operating have not actually been conducive to greater sustainability and to allowing greater affordability. And that's the dynamic that we're trying to change, both for students and for faculty and staff. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Neil Janssen. I'm a graduate student. I have a question on something similar, which is the Gage South neighborhood.
Yes.
So as part of this land use plan, the consultation started with an ideas gathering fair. And a number of students, as well as the AMS, told Campus Community Planning that Gage South is something that we would like to talk about as part of these. Mm-hmm. In the documentation that went to the board, the borders for the South Campus neighborhood is changing. East Campus is changing. A new one at Acadia is being created. University Boulevard is changing. Thunderbird is disappearing. North Campus is also disappearing. And somehow Gage South made it onto that map unchanged. And I'm just wondering how we can have an honest, good faith discussion about Gage South neighborhood, because it doesn't seem to be on the radar of Campus Community Planning, and they don't seem to be willing to engage in discussion over whether this neighborhood is appropriately located.
Right. Thank you. So the short answer is that there will be an open discussion about the Gage neighborhood. So rest assured that it will be part of the overall discussion. There were some technical reasons that it wasn't included in the first submission to the board, but those are being sorted out, and I promise you that it will form part of our overall discussion. The central issue for me is we're all, as a community, going to have to find means to understand that when you have a community that is vitally a part of a living, a working community, not just separated out from the surrounding environment, there are going to be some kind of interface that will at times be less than optimal. So I think what we have to do for Gage personally is figure out what makes most sense for its location in relation to student housing and all of the other things, and in relation to what developments will take place on University Boulevard, to make sure that it will be a happy and successful community for the people living there and for the people who are living next to it, mostly students. So all of that will be on the table. We have to figure out what the right balance is, but you know, we do have have to resist. I mean, one of the great problems of any kind of community planning, and those of you who've worked, never mind in universities, but in municipalities, know that you can very easily fall into what's called NIMBYism, the not in my backyard phenomenon. And there are lots of places where, you know, making choices will not be perfect from everyone's perspective, but I think we do have to find ways of living together as a community, and that's what we're going to have to figure out with Gage. But I do promise you, it's not off the table for discussion, and we are actually trying to think creatively about how best to do it in a way that will maximize the opportunity for good interaction between students and others who might be there. It might turn out, for example, that that could focus primarily on graduate student housing, or it might focus primarily on housing for younger adults or single parent or single not family housing. So I mean, there are ways of doing it that I think could actually change the dynamic. Yes.
Hi, my name is Hugh Brown. I work at the Center for High Throughput Biology. You mentioned that UBC's Vancouver campus is no longer under the supervision of the City of Vancouver.
Well, it never was. It was the Metro Vancouver, the GVRD.
Sorry. Metro Vancouver. So when it comes to issues like planning, it would seem that UBC is the one making the plans and the one doing the supervision, and there's a lack of democratically elected officials that can be voted out if it comes to that. What provision is going to be made for such democratic options?
Great question. The first point is that even in the interim period, UBC is not judge and jury on its own, because all of the plans that will be produced after public consultation must actually be approved by the minister. So it's not just us deciding and then having a no say. And I can tell you that the minister's regulations so far have been very rigorous. They've said, you know, who has to be consulted, where does the consultation have to take place, what does the public hearing look like. So my sense is the minister is going to take his or her role, depending on who it is at the time, very, very seriously. So that's the first point. Second point is we're in an interim period, and the government was really clear on that. What we have now is a period before we get into the broader governance discussion. Currently, there are elected officials through the UNA, the University Neighborhoods Association. So there are people who represent the housing areas on campus currently. I don't know whether that will be a continued model or whether there will be a different model, but that's subject to a wide discussion over the course of the next couple of years, I would assume. There will be governance changes taking place. So what we're in now is this interim period, and we're committed, and the board has committed itself to really take a rigorous look at governance to ensure that democratic participation is possible.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Peverell. I'm an engineering undergrad student. I came here from, I did a year post-secondary in Eastern Canada, and I want to know if you're aware that, particularly for students trying to get post-secondary from lesser-known institutions, that it's a real difficulty to get your credits fairly assessed and evaluated. It's a process that takes several months, and yeah, I think it really comes from just there's inefficiency between admissions, the corresponding faculties, and the faculty you want to get into. And when you don't meet the specific case, it's a lot of effort for them, so they're more likely to not have the time for you and brush you off when you're a student who's really just looking for credits for the things that you legitimately did. You want to just move on and be able to take the courses that you want to take.
Thank you. So I've certainly heard that before. You're not the first person to say it, and it does worry me, I have to be honest. It's hard to evaluate sometimes programs at other institutions, and of course there are so many other institutions that exist that we don't have a template that can automatically be applied across the board. So a lot of situations are specific. I guess the part that worries me is your sense that perhaps you've been blown off and not taken seriously in this. That should never happen. And you know, to the extent that overburdened administrative people are perhaps not being provided with the support they need or the clarity that they need around making decisions, then we've got a problem. So I think you've pointed out something important. If I could ask, if you can stay, we're going to end fairly soon, if you could stay afterwards, I want to put you in touch with someone who can maybe really do a little exploring on that for me. Thank you very much. I think last question right over here.
Hi, my name is Regan Heng Zhang, and I am a new graduate student. I would just like to ask your opinion, given the current events for the, during the past few weeks, what would be the future for the relationship between the university and the fraternity spillage, and how confident are we in dedicating land use for organizations that don't seem to be contributing positively to the campus? Thank you.
That's a fair question. So I guess I'd start by saying I was never a member of a fraternity, so I didn't experience the life of the fraternity, but I do talk to many people from UBC and elsewhere who did experience that life. And for many people, it is the place that they find their grounding and really their home in a very large institution. So I don't think I would join you in saying that they, the fraternities and sororities don't play an important role. I think for many people, on a huge campus, they are that place where the big is made small, and that's what we're looking for. And there are lots of different ways of doing that. There are, you know, there's the Abdullah Science Center, there are clubs, there are activities, there are sports programs, there's theater, there's music. But for some people, there are fraternities and sororities. So I wouldn't, you know, lightly treat them as unimportant. Having said that, clearly what happened not this last weekend but the weekend before was very disturbing. And there seemed to be a lack of ability to manage a situation that was in many ways created by the desire of the fraternities to reach out to large groups of people to encourage them to become members. So at one level, as you point out, the university is renting, effectively leasing space to the fraternities. On the other hand, members of the fraternities are our students, so we can't absolve ourselves from responsibility. It's a combination that we now have to work on very, very forcefully. I know that the Vice President's students and other people in his portfolio have been working very hard to make sure that we are helping the fraternities talk to their neighbors, helping the fraternities to think about how they might plan in a different way so that these kinds of incidents are not repeated. The one thing I am sure about is we cannot let what happened at some sister universities happen here, where there was an out-of-control element that developed over a number of years so that the university becomes known as the drinking or the party school, and where, you know, in some cases, whole activities had to be completely shut down. I don't want to get there, so we want to be active, aggressive on this quickly, working in partnership with the fraternities and, indeed, with our student government to make sure that responsible heads prevail, and that we provide the help that the fraternities may need to do this properly. Well, I'm sorry that we can't go on all afternoon. I'm sure I would be delighted to do so, but others of you actually have work to do, I'm sure. I'd like to thank you very much for the questions and for your attention. If there are any issues that you weren't able to address, then please do send in questions, and I promise you you'll get an answer back. And I would, again, encourage you to look at Place and Promise and the report on the first few months of implementation.
And welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And that was UBC President Stephen Toop as he presided over the annual town hall at the Chan Center. In the hour-long forum, Professor Toop provided an update on Place and Promise, UBC's strategic plan, and answered questions to a crowd of over 100. Throughout the hour, Stop Animal Research UBC activists scattered throughout the crowd silently protested the university's use of animals in research. About 10 activists held up signs bringing attention to the issue. They were not asked to leave the town hall, and UBC Professor Toop, as you heard earlier, actually addressed them and took the opportunity to talk about animal research at UBC. And that concludes our program for September 20th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a story idea, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team here at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.